Welcome to this Good Lit podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California. The Good Lit series brings literary and culinary luminaries to the podium. I'm Gina Baleria, Director of Literary Events at the club. To learn more about our programs or become a member, go to commonwealthclub.org. To take part in a discussion about what you hear, blog at commonwealthlit.blogspot.com.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Julia Flynn Seiler, author of The House of Mondavi, The Rise and Fall of an American Wine Dynasty, and a contributing writer for the Wall Street Journal. This program is part of our Good Lit series, generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It's also part of LitQuake, and is co-organized by the California Historical Society and the San Francisco Museum and Historical Society. Truth really can be more intriguing than fiction. California was built on big personalities, intrigue, scandal, and drama. Tonight, our panel of authors will delve into the past, bringing the stories that shaped the Golden State to life again, and we'll discuss how we became who we are. They will also prove that history can sometimes be the greatest story of all. Our panelists are Francis Dinkelspiel, author, Towers of Gold, How One Jewish Immigrant Named Isaias Hellman Created California, Ethan Rarick, author, Desperate Passage, The Donner Party's Perilous Journey, and Rick Wortsman, author, Obscene in the Extreme, The Burning and Banning of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. Francis, let's begin with you. Tell us a little bit about I.W. Hellman, Isaias Hellman, and why you decided to write about him.
Thanks, Julie. Well, Isaias Hellman was probably one of the greatest financiers of the late 19th and early 20th century. He was instrumental in taking California from a frontier that was based on the barter of hides and the exchange of gold dust into one of the most powerful states in the country. When people think of, you know, the Wild West, they think of gun battles and violence and cowboys and Indians. Well, there was another kind of Wild West, and that was the financial system. During the 19th century, there were numerous bank panics and bank runs. Credit was really tight, and interest rates were really high. And Isaias, just like today, there are a lot of parallels. Anyway, Isaias Hellman was instrumental in taming the financial system of the Wild West. He started the first successful bank in Los Angeles, and he rose up to become president of Wells Fargo Bank and many other numerous institutions. So he was instrumental in helping families find money to buy homes, for farmers to get the cash they needed to plant crops, and for businesses to grow. He was very important in getting money for places like Southern Pacific Railway or for the water companies and the gas companies and the electricity companies up and down the state. So I was really interested in telling a story about a man who was so important in the transformation of California.
Thank you. Now, Ethan, around the same time, Isaias Hellman was when he was still a little boy in Germany, and more than a decade before he made his way to California, the infamous Donner Party was stranded with dwindling rations over the winter in the Sierra Nevada. What drew you to writing about this horrifying case of survival cannibalism?
Well, what drew me to it initially was one of the characters, and was a specific moment in the story, I guess. There's a moment in the story in which a little girl named Patty Reed, who's 8 years old, must be sent back. She and her mother and her siblings are trying to walk out with some rescuers. They're stranded up at Donner Lake. Most of you know where Donner Lake is in the Sierra. They're trying to walk over to present-day Sacramento. Patty can't go on, and she and one of her brothers must go back to the lake, where there are some other survivors who were too weak to go out. Margaret Reed has to divide her children. She sends two ahead with the rescue party as they try to walk out. She sends Patty and Tommy back to the lake. She decides, after much contemplation, to go ahead with the rescue party, to go with her two older children to try to help them get out. So she's sending Patty and Tommy back by themselves, basically. And there is every reason at this point in the story to think that they will die. That, as it turns out, I will tell you, they live. But it seems as if almost surely they're going to die. And as they are leaving, as Margaret goes ahead with her two other kids, Patty looks at her mother and says, "Well, Ma, if I never see you again, just do the best you can." And as I was reading, I came across this before I even decided to write about the Donner Party. I was just reading about, I wanted to write something about the overland migration to the West, and I had come across the Donner Party, as one does inevitably. And I come upon this moment, and it seemed to me so plain-spoken, so and yet so courageous, so simple. There was nothing melodramatic about it. It's an acknowledgement from an 8-year-old girl that she's probably going to die. I sort of, at that moment, I think I kind of fell in love with Patty, and I just thought, I have to write about these people. These people are just amazing. And so that's what really drew me to the story. And ultimately, I think it kind of informed the way I look at the story, because to me, what makes the Donner Party such an interesting story, and the reason it's captivated people for 150 years, is that these are regular people going through this extraordinary event. This isn't a military expedition or an exploratory expedition. It isn't Shackleton going to the South Pole or anything. Wonderful stories, much to teach us. But these are real people, families, kids, farmers, merchants, going through the most extraordinary experience of their lives. And so that moment was the moment I thought I had to write about it, and it also ultimately, I think, kind of helped me to think about the story or to understand the story, I guess.
Thank you. That's a great explanation. Rick, just like Ethan's book helps us see the Donner Party very differently than we might have thought we knew the story, your book offers a surprising explanation for the controversy surrounding The Grapes of Wrath, the publication of The Grapes of Wrath. What initially led you to this story, and what was the surprise you found?
Right. It was actually a photograph that led me to the story. In researching the first book I wrote with Mark Arax, The King of California, there's a minor character in that book, a gentleman by the name of Bill Camp, who was part of the Associated Farmers, this giant growers group that was very powerful in the 1930s. And I had seen a photograph of Bill Camp presiding over this little book burning of The Grapes of Wrath. And as you can imagine, it's the kind of image that always sort of stays in your mind. And I was actually at a book reading in Bakersfield, standing outside in the parking lot after it was done, talking to a friend of mine, a poet by the name of Lee McCarthy. And somehow this photo came up, and Lee said, "Have you ever seen that?" And I said, "Yeah, actually, boy, I know that photograph really well." And it instantly came back to me. And then she said, "Well, do you know anything about the librarian?" I said, "What do you mean the librarian?" She said, "Oh, well, there was this brave librarian who fought the censorship." And I thought, "Oh, that's pretty interesting." So I started to scratch around at it, and what I found was that, indeed, The Grapes of Wrath had stirred a lot of controversy, not just in Kern County, but around the country. And the book was banned, and in other places, burned as well, East St. Louis, Illinois, for instance, really on obscenity grounds. Steinbeck's use of profanity, you know, hardly shocking by today's HBO standards or anything, but for that day and age, even critics who liked the novel thought that many readers would find it shocking, and particularly the last scene, as many of you may recall, where Rose of Sharon, having just had this stillborn baby, gives her breast to this starving stranger. You know, that was just too much for some people. So the book was banned on obscenity grounds around the country. What I found, though, as I dug into the Kern County story and what led me to really think there was a book there, was that the Kern County folks, they didn't just stop at obscenity, although they opposed The Grapes of Wrath on that grounds. They opposed it really on political grounds. And the resolution that the County Board of Supervisors passed in August 1939, banning the novel from local schools and libraries, cited not just obscenity, but they condemned Steinbeck for depicting a community that was, quote-unquote, breathing class hatred. Breathing class hatred. And really, that's what my book ends up being about. It's really a window into the class politics of the 1930s. And you can see this deep struggle between far left and far right in America and certainly in California kind of played out through the tussle over Steinbeck's novel.
Now, Rick, there seem to be some similarities between what happened in Bakersfield in 1939 when the growers, as you said, mounted a campaign against the novel and the political and social climate we're experiencing now, especially with Sarah Palin's request to remove books from the Wasilla Public Library.
Right.
What does the threat of book banning say about our time?
Well, it says that it's alive and well. You know, there's the American Library Association tells us that there are about 2,000 books challenged around the country every year. You know, it's interesting. There's a lot of misinformation about what Sarah Palin did or didn't do floating around the internet, so we all need to be careful. But she does seem to have taken issue with a particular book at the Wasilla Library called Daddy's Roommate, which is a book that is actually meant to teach children, explain to children about homosexuality. And what I thought was really striking in the New York Times account, her former campaign manager, the manager of her mayoral campaign, talks about how she knew that Sarah Palin had a problem with this book. She then decided to read it herself. The campaign manager did, a woman, I think her name was Laura Chase. And she says, you know, I read it, didn't find it very offensive, so I suggested that Sarah actually read it. And she said, oh, no, I don't need to read any of that stuff. You know, I know what's in there. And I thought that was particularly telling. And I think, you know, frankly, it's the kind of thing that all of us need to be vigilant about. We need to recognize that there still is a lot of censorship out there, that books are challenged, ideas are challenged, and when we see it, we need to stand up.
Thank you. Francis, do you see any parallels between the financial crisis we're in now and the world that Isaias Hellman lived in?
Absolutely. Except for in Isaias Hellman's time, he was able to single-handedly stop a bank run on his own. And unfortunately, the world is so much more complex that even the $700 billion bailout by the U.S. Congress doesn't seem to be having the desired effect. Well, yes, in the 19th century, as I mentioned earlier, banks were completely unregulated. In fact, in California, banks were illegal until 1871. Since California had been founded on gold, the people who crafted the Constitution in 1849 thought that the state could be run on gold. There was no need for pesky bankers or even greenbacks, and they said that gold currency was going to be the specie that we would use. So for a long time, anyone could set up a bank, and this ultimately led to a lot of bank failures. And so people would put their money in a bank and go back, a couple months later, and sometimes that money was no longer there. So there was one time in 1893 that was remarkably like today. After the Civil War, the United States went through a tremendous period of growth. There was a huge expansion of railroads across the country, and those railroads were funded by the issuances of stocks and bonds. And there was a small cadre of people who got very, very wealthy through this, and there are names that are very familiar to America, people like J.P. Morgan and Jacob Schiff and the robber barons and the people we associated with the Gilded Age. Anyway, in 1893, the President of the United States started talking to Congress about changing the monetary system from one based on gold to one based on silver. And this spooked European investors who started taking their money out of the United States. And in June of 1893, the governor of California was actually in Chicago at the opening of the exposition there, and he was extolling the virtues of California at its opening exhibit, telling everyone that California was doing millions of dollars of trade in agriculture, and it was doing trade with the Far East, and mining was going well. And the end of his statement, he said, "The financial system is all right." Little did he know that the next day in Los Angeles, people got nervous about this silver thing happening, and they rushed to all the banks downtown, and they started taking out their money. And by the end of the day, people in LA had taken out around $3 million. And the next morning, things were even worse. So many people were lined up on downtown intersection of Spring and Main Street that the police had to sort of push people against the walls of the buildings. Everything was crowded. And many banks were not opening because they knew they could not weather another bank run. So Isaias Hellman had started a bank called the Farmers and Merchants Bank, which was the first successful bank in L.A. And in 1893, he was head of the Nevada Bank up in San Francisco. And his brother called him from L.A. and said, "Isaias, you better get down here with money because our bank is going to run out of money." And at first, Isaias Hellman was not really that concerned about the bank run. He thought there were sufficient resources at the Farmers and Merchants Bank. But soon it became clear there wasn't. So he took about $500,000 of his own money from the vaults of the Nevada Bank and loaded it into a rail car. and that's about $11 million today, and got on the rail car and started his way towards L.A. Well, it took a lot longer to get to L.A. back in 1893. It took about 24 hours. And so everybody's eyes were on that rail car. The mayor of L.A. kept calling up Southern Pacific Railway saying, come, get that rail car down here. All the bankers were looking at the rail car. And when it pulled into the downtown station in Los Angeles, rumors began to fly throughout the city that Hellman was in town. And people actually started to say, Hellman is in town, Hellman is in town. And this huge crowd rushed down to the San Fernando Depot and watched as Hellman oversaw the unloading of all these bags of gold. And they loaded them into a wagon, and they put them. They took them to Farmers and Merchants Bank. And Hellman loaded up all these coins of gold and big towers of gold on the counters of the bank. And when people saw that, their panic subsided. They realized that there was enough liquidity in the market that they didn't need to be worried about what was going on. And Hellman, in that one gesture, which unfortunately is hard to replicate today, was able to assure people that there was enough credit.
Hence the title of your book, Towers of Gold. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. As part of LitQuake, San Francisco's literary festival, tonight we're talking with a panel of authors about the scandal, intrigue, and drama that can be found in California history. Our panelists are Francis Dinkelspiel, author, Towers of Gold; Ethan Rarick, author, Desperate Passage, The Donner Party's Perilous Journey; and Rick Wortsman, author, Obscene in the Extreme, The Burning and Banning of John Steinbeck's The Grape's Wrath. And I am your moderator, Julia Flynn Seiler, the author of The House of Mondavi. Ethan, rather than sensationalizing the history of the Donner Party or condemning the characters for the cannibalism they were forced to resort to, your book very skillfully and very beautifully lays the groundwork for the reader to feel compassion for the Donner Party's terrible ordeal. And I was wondering if, in part, that was because you retraced their journey and you were able to describe in such exquisite detail what they saw and what they might have felt. Could you tell us a little bit about your experience of following the trail the Donner Party took?
Sure, and maybe that's what led me to be sympathetic to them. I don't know. I did retrace the path of the party. I went back to Independence, Missouri, and then drove out following the route to Donner Lake, intermittently hiking parts of it. I hiked over the Continental Divide right where they crossed it in the middle of Wyoming, out in the middle of nowhere. Looks exactly today as it did then. There's nothing out there still, which may say something about Wyoming. But and it's remarkable how closely you can follow the path, in part because they went to famous places, things like Independence Rock that are still obviously there and that are still famous and that are national landmarks, in part because the West is such an arid climate that you can still, as many of you probably know, you can still see wheel ruts from the old wagons going west in many parts of the trail. There are people who are intensely interested in the precise route. They call themselves rut nuts because they go out and find the ruts. I'm not a rut nut. I don't care whether they went to the left of that hill or the right of that hill. It doesn't matter. But so maybe that's what gave me sympathy. But I have to say, I never really started with a view of condemnation toward them, even with regard to the cannibalism, or maybe I should say especially with regard to the cannibalism, because the cannibalism, of course, is the defining moment of the story. It's the reason we all know about the Donner Party. If they don't resort to cannibalism, I don't think anybody knows who the Donner Party is today. So it's the most extraordinary moment of the story. I always found it odd that people would condemn cannibalism in that circumstance. I think that it was almost in a strange way sort of a noble thing to do. I think that they were doing what they had to do to survive, what they had to do to help their children to survive, what they had to do to come through the ordeal to take care of their children. And I think that it is a perfectly logical and, as I say, almost noble thing, with one exception. There were two people who were killed in order to be eaten. That, I think, is morally unacceptable. But in every other case in the Donner Party, this is cannibalism involving the bodies of people who are already dead. And I've said before, sometimes people laugh at this, but I've said before that I thought about this a lot, and if I were in that kind of situation, I hope I would have the courage to resort to cannibalism if I had to. And if I had died, I hope that other people would use my body if it helped them to survive. So I never really started with this view of condemning them, even though they were, at various points in history, they have been condemned, surely, for resorting to cannibalism. Some of them later tried to deny that they had resorted to cannibalism. So there was always an undercurrent of condemnation in the way the story is viewed, but I just never saw that. It always seemed to me like something that they did what they had to do to survive, and that's a sort of almost noble instinct, I think.
Now, you incorporate new archaeological findings into your story. Would you tell us about those findings and explain how they changed our understanding of what happened to the Donner Party in that terrible winter of 1846, 1847?
Well, the new information sort of falls really into three categories, I would say, of which archaeology is only one. And this is always a question that comes up because, Lord knows, there's a lot of stuff out there about the Donner Party. There are lots of books. There are novels. There's an epic poem. There's a one-man play. There's a ballet. There's an opera, believe it or not. There is even one book published about the Donner Party called The Donner Party Cookbook. I hasten to add, it's not what you think. It is recipes that they made on the trail going out or that emigrants made. So shame on you for thinking that, by the way. So there's a lot of stuff. So why another Donner Party book? Well, there's three types of new information. The archaeological information, actually, to me, is the least interesting. There have been a variety of digs at Donner Lake and at the other site, Alder Creek, through the years, including just within the last few years. And they've helped to identify where the sites were exactly. They've given us some minor details, shards of pottery, shards of a slate that was apparently being used in the camp. We know one of the figures in the story, Tamsin Donner, was a school teacher, and so we sort of surmised that perhaps she was giving lessons to her children, even as they were freezing to death out there. So the archaeological evidence gives you some little details. There's also new sort of scientific evidence that's not directly related necessarily to the Donner Party, but that you can apply to it. So we know much more about what happens to people as they starve than we did 100 years ago when people first began to tell the story, or 70 years ago when the most popular version of the story was written, Ordeal by Hunger by George Stewart. We know much more about what happens to people as they starve. We know more about climactic conditions. We know more about the exact winter of 1846. We know now, for instance, that it was not a particularly harsh winter, as people long thought. It was early, but not harsh. And then the third, and in my view, best type of new information is there's actually new archival information that's emerged within the last, in one case, within the last decade or so. In the mid-90s, late 90s, the descendant of a survivor donated a new collection of letters and other documents to the Huntington Library in Southern California. And those had been used in various journal articles, but never in a book before. And they shed new light onto some of the characters, particularly Tamsin Donner, the wife of the captain, George Donner. There is a series of letters that she wrote to her sister after the death of her first family. Her first family had died very suddenly. And I think that those letters really give new insight into her character, into what she does at the end of the story, which is as poignant as any character in the story. So I think that really the new archival information, new letters, new documents, that's where we really learn the most and really gain the greatest knowledge about the characters.
And you discussed very briefly how the women survived to at a higher rate than the men did.
They did. And there are sort of three interesting aspects of the survival rates of the Donner Party. One, women survived at a higher rate than men, and that fits in with what we now know about physiology. Women, for instance, have a higher percentage of body fat on average than men do, so in starvation situations they tend to do better. Second interesting survival fact is that the old and the young died in great numbers. The children died, and there were lots of children, by the way. These were big families. So there were 81 people trapped in the mountains. Half of them were under 18, and a quarter were 5 or younger. So lots and lots of kids. Kids tended to die. Older people tended to die. Anybody over 40 tended to die. And then the third and most interesting to me fact is that people without families almost inevitably died. And that seems to have outweighed the other factors. For example, the greatest number of people who didn't have any families were young men in their 20s, prime of life, best physical condition of their lives. They had been hired as teamsters to come along with the families. So they didn't have wives. They didn't have children. They almost all died. It was the women who were in their 20s and 30s who tended to live. And again, this the fact that people died if they didn't have families with them tends to comport with other knowledge that we have. There's an interesting study done recently, for instance, of survival rates in Andersonville, the famous Confederate prison camp in the Civil War, that found that if you were imprisoned with someone from your hometown, you had a better chance of survival than if you were imprisoned with strangers. And we think there are two reasons for that. One, family members and friends are more likely to help you physically. They can get you food, they can help you if you're sick, etc. And number two, they simply provide emotional sustenance. They give you a reason to go on. There's a really interesting entry in one of the letters by a guy named James Reed talking about one of the young men who died in their 20s. And Reed says he did not starve, he just gave up. So even at the time, people had this sense that these young men were just dying because they just didn't have anybody to sort of keep them going. So the survival is interesting, not just for the women surviving more than the men, but in various ways you see some overlapping reasons for survival.
Rick, this is a question from the audience, but I think I'll address it to you.
Okay.
When writing, do you feel like drawing parallels to larger historical phenomena is important, or is it enough to just tell someone or some group's story? And I address this question to you because in your book, Obscene in the Extreme, it's much broader than simply the banning and burning of the Grapes of Wrath. And your book is really almost a social history of the period, and you've woven that together so well.
Right. Yeah, for me, that really was, again, what made the book. The way that Obscene in the Extreme is constructed, the way the narrative works, it actually all unfolds over 1 week. The Board of Supervisors met on August 21st, 1939, in Bakersfield. They voted to ban Steinbeck's novel from schools and libraries. And there was a kind of furor over the course of that week. In the middle of the week, there was this little book burning that occurred that I refer to the picture. And then the following Monday, they were set to re-vote and decide whether to uphold the ban, uphold the censorship or not. And, you know, that narrative thread, it carries all the way through, and there's a little bit of drama. There's one or two board members who sort of talk about maybe switching their votes and going from favoring the ban to opposing the ban. And so there's some question of whether the censorship would hold or not. There's a kind of a backlash, as you can imagine, from townsfolk and civil libertarians in Kern County, which there were a surprising number in those days, who were fighting the censorship. And so all that carries through. But again, what this really is about is this bigger tussle between right and left in the state. And again, you can really see it play out. And you know, what I conclude is that the real reason that Steinbeck's novel was censored by the Board of Supervisors and the Associated Farmers kind of standing behind them in Kern County is because this was a group of people who really feared what Steinbeck was saying. You know, Steinbeck really came pretty close to calling for revolution in The Grapes of Wrath. I've read the book now, read the novel four or five times, and it wasn't until I immersed myself in the politics of the 30s that I began to really understand what a radical book The Grapes of Wrath is, and again, in the context of when it was written. This was a time Colbert Olson, as some of you may know, had just been elected governor of California. He was the first Democrat elected governor in California in the 20th century. He was a longtime protege of Upton Sinclair, a socialist who nearly won the governorship as a Democrat 4 years before in 1934. You know, this was a strange and nervous time if you were part of the establishment, a big farming interest, big business interest, if you had something to lose. People were talking about revolution. Steinbeck talked about there's a revolution going on. In terms that, you know, we were talking backstage, right? People weren't talking about revolution like it's, you know, some Nike ad using the word revolution. I mean, this was really, you know, the Russian Revolution was fresh in people's minds. There were communist, openly communist labor organizers running around the farm fields of the San Joaquin Valley trying to get workers to unionize. You know, there were 400,000 people who had poured out of the Dust Bowl and other parched plain states and parts of the Southwest had come to California, and nobody knew where they would fall politically, ideologically. There was a lot of nervousness. One of the first things that Colbert Olson did as governor, the first thing he did was release Tom Mooney from prison, the longtime militant activist, labor activist, who had been really falsely imprisoned for planting a suitcase bomb at this parade right here in San Francisco 23 years before. He lets Mooney out of jail. Mooney goes on the floor of the legislature and delivers this dramatic speech where he basically says, capitalism's dead. And a lot of people thought capitalism was dead. Unemployment was still over 17% in this country in 1939. It felt like capitalism was dead. And Steinbeck, among many others, really thought that some form of socialism was about to replace it. The next thing Governor Olson does, if people on the right aren't nervous enough now, he names as head of his state farm worker policy none other than Kerry McWilliams. As many of you may know, Kerry McWilliams had just written a book that many still see as the nonfiction counterpart to The Grapes of Wrath, the book Factories in the Field. And Factories in the Field concludes with McWilliams calling for the Soviet-style collectivization of all private agriculture in California. And now he's not just some nuisance with a pen. He's actually in charge of farm worker policy in the state, and he begins to hold hearings to set wages in the farm fields across the state. So again, really nervous time. And then this book, The Grapes of Wrath, it bursts on the scene. And, you know, 430,000 copies sell nationally that first year. It's the most popular book in the country. And it's basically calling for revolution. And so, you know, my thesis really, and this is what runs through the book, is that, you know, people worried that California in particular, with this deep right-left divide, was like a tinderbox, and The Grapes of Wrath might be the match that would set everything off.
You're listening.
Can I
just
say real quickly on that question? I think it depends on the story. I can think of books that where you have to relate the story to some broader theme, and I can think of books, great books of history, fun stuff to read. I don't know, Seabiscuit. I don't know what Seabiscuit has to do with some broader theme, but boy, it was a lot of fun to read. So I think the short answer is it depends on the story. To me.
I think that's true. Although even Seabiscuit, I think, you know, one of the great things about it to me was that it so laid out the context of the times, and it was, you know, a nation hungering for a hero,
right,
and all that stuff. So, I mean,
same era as your book.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So part of the story.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. As part of Litquake, San Francisco's literary festival, tonight we're talking with a panel of authors about the scandal, intrigue, and drama that can be found in California history. Our panelists are Francis Dinkelspiel, author, Towers of Gold; Ethan Rarick, author, Desperate Passage, The Donner Party's Perilous Journey; and Rick Wortsman, author, Obscene in the Extreme, The Burning and Banning of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. And I am your moderator, Julia Flynn Seiler, the author of The House of Mondavi. Rick, both your and Ethan's books have a background of the Great Western Migration. And likewise, Isaias Hellman's story is a remarkable rags-to-riches story of a poor immigrant who came from Germany and landed in California and became one of the most powerful men in California during his time. And interestingly, again, we were talking backstage of how Hellman was on the opposite side of those types of class struggles, if you'd like to frame it that way. Could you talk a little bit about that, Francis?
Certainly. Well, Isaias Hellman started out as a sort of almost penniless immigrant, and he worked his way up to become one of the richest men in California. In fact, the newspapers often dubbed him the richest Jew in the West. And they said his fortune was worth $40 million, which was an overstatement, but he never corrected them. Hellman came to San Francisco in 1890 to take over something called the Nevada Bank, which had been started by the Silver Kings during the Comstock Lode. And he really transformed that bank into one of the most powerful institutions in California. And he started to sell a lot of bonds for various companies like Southern Pacific and the Spring Valley Water Company. And he became quite part of the establishment. And in later part of his life, he sort of reacted to the labor struggles. And just like Rick was mentioning earlier, there's always been a tension between labor and capital in California. And certainly Hellman was in the center of that. And it really came to play right around the time of the San Francisco earthquake. In 1902, San Francisco had elected its first sort of labor-oriented mayor, a man named Eugene Schmitz. And after the earthquake, it became very clear that Eugene Schmitz had been on the take. There was a man named Abe Roof, who was a lawyer, who went to all the big businesses in town and said, I will be happy to get your bill passed if only you hire me as a consultant and pay me a certain amount of money. So after the earthquake, there were a series of trials in San Francisco called the Graff Trials, in which Eugene Schmidt, Abe Roof, and the whole board of supervisors were put on trial and accused of bribery. And Isaias Hellman happened to be on the board of something called the United Railroads, which controlled the trolley cars in San Francisco. And that company was accused of bribing the mayor and the board of supervisors for $200,000. Now, I didn't find any evidence that Hellman was connected with the bribe, but he was a witness in many of the trials. And he became personified as sort of Mr. Capital in San Francisco. Fremont Older, who was the editor of the Call newspaper, used to write about him scathingly in his editorials on a regular basis. Anyway, the earthquake came, and there was a tremendous amount of help from around the world, and it was a good time for labor because people were able to do a lot of rebuilding, and there was plenty of work to go around. And right after the earthquake happened, there was the Panama Pacific International Exposition, and that was a time when San Francisco could show the world that it had risen like a phoenix from the ashes, and it was a glorious city. But the day the PPIE closed, labor essentially set down its demands and said, we want an 8-hour workday. We want to be paid well. And for men like Hellman and other capitalists in the city, they were taken by surprise by this. They had worked so hard to bring San Francisco back from the brink that they were essentially dismayed by the rise of capital. And Hellman and other men like him funded a number of sort of anti-union activities because they felt that San Francisco should be an open shop. They felt San Francisco should not be controlled by the unions. And just to go to one thing that Rick had just mentioned, sort of the biggest characterization of this came in 1916 when the United States was having a debate about whether or not to enter World War I. And there was something called the Preparedness Day Parade, where men like Hellman and all the business classes of the city put on a parade to say, yes, we think the United States should go to war and we should start to be prepared for this. Now, many of the labor unions and working men felt that World War I was a war for the rich men, and they were very opposed to this. And so during the course of the war, a bomb went off, many, many people were killed, and it really sparked this tremendous explosion between labor and capital in San Francisco. And Hellman, during that time, was most decidedly wanting San Francisco to return to normal. He felt that it should be calm, there shouldn't be strikes, business should be allowed to proceed as it had in the past, and so he fought very hard for that.
This is a question from the audience, and I think I'll toss it out to the whole panel and see what it comes up with. Interesting, provocative question. Do you have to be emotionally engaged in order to work on a book or story? And in turn, how do you try to become emotionally engaged in your subject? Please.
Do you have to be? I don't know if you have to be. And it's interesting. I've had a lot of people ask me, was I emotionally engaged in the Donner Party story in a negative way, if that's the word, i.e. was it difficult to write about people eating each other and dying and so on and so forth? And I always say no. So I was going to say for a moment that I wasn't emotionally engaged in the story. On the other hand, then I just realized that when I was talking about the book, the first thing I said to you all tonight is that I fell in love with one of the characters and then subsequently fell in love with the entire party. So I did become emotionally engaged, I guess. It certainly helps, I think. I think the question was, how do you do that? I think it's actually the reverse. My guess is, tell me if I'm wrong for you two, but my guess is most of us, you get emotionally engaged, and that's what causes you to work on it. That's what causes you to write the book rather than the other. It's not that you decide to write the book and then sort of struggle to get emotionally engaged. but you have to get engaged emotionally and intellectually in every other way, I think, and then you decide to write.
I think that's dead on. And in fact, you know, I always say to young writers who ask or people who are interested, say, you know, I have a book I want to write. You know, the first thing I always ask them is, are you passionate about it? Do you really love this? Because you're going to live with it for a long time before anybody else ever sees it. You know, my book, this one took 4 years to do. And it really, I have a day job and so was doing other things, but there's always a piece of it that's with you. You know, you're marinating in all this material, and it really takes a certain passion. You've got to love what you're doing, or I think, frankly, if you ever even get the book out on the other end, it's just going to be flat on the page. So I think passion, at least, if not, other emotions too.
Well, I think you have to be engaged. In my case, my book took 8 years, and I had to go through about 50,000 pages of documents. And when you're reading old Germanic script and you can barely detect what it means, you really have to be interested in your topic.
I'll just address this as wear a different hat, and that is the author of The House of Mondavi. And I came to that story, that book, as a journalist and really didn't know very much about the wine industry, but found myself very passionately interested in the family drama and landed in the middle of it during a time when the principal players in this drama were very emotional. And so it actually is pretty helpful to not be close to the family, to be fairly objective, and not to be a Napa Valley insider, but somebody who was just reporting on the collapse, the loss of control of the Mondavi Empire by the family. So, another question from the audience. As a history author, do you find it more or less valid to draw parallels to modern today's times? Anyone want to tackle that one?
I think that history really does, you know, there are a lot of echoes, and you know, you can hear them, you know, certainly in Francis's story, certainly in, you know, in the burning and banning of the Grapes of Wrath. I mean, I talked about, you know, the parallels to today with censorship. Certainly, you know, some of the economic conditions, you know, we're seeing, right, headlines, you know, worst financial crisis since the 1930s. You know, there are definitely a lot of parallels. There are even parallels to the whole migration experience. You know, those fields have not changed a whole lot where people pick the crops. They look the same. The faces have changed as to who's picking them, right? Mostly Mexican now, and increasingly people who aren't even Spanish speakers, but speaking Mixtec and Oaxacan and other indigenous languages. But the fields look the same. And interestingly, a lot of the xenophobia that people who come from south of the border feel, a lot of the fear and suspicion, the Okies felt the same fear and suspicion. You know, in Kern County, you know, there are official county health reports that talk about the migrants who came in the 30s as social leeches and chiselers and drunks. You know, that was right in an official county health report. You can imagine what the word on the street was, right? So there's even a measure of illegality at that time. Some of you may know it was actually against the law in the 30s to bring a destitute person across state lines into California. If you can believe that. This was commonly known as the anti-Okie law, and there were scores of prosecutions. People actually prosecuted for bringing their poor relatives here from Oklahoma and Arkansas and elsewhere. That was eventually overturned in a Supreme Court case in 1941, Edwards versus California. But, you know, even there's this parallel, kind of this notion of it's, you know, there's an illegal aspect to the whole thing. So not perfect parallels, and you have to be careful not to overdraw them, but I think we really do learn from history, and I think it's entirely appropriate to connect those dots.
I'd like to address that. I agree with you, Rick, but I also think when you are writing a history, you have to be very careful not to take your modern mindset and sort of impose it on the people that you're researching. It's very important to understand the context of the time that they lived in and see how they thought. And, you know, and if you're trying to interpret motivation of people's actions, you have to see it from that particular prism. I mean, it's very easy now to look back and say, oh, yes, why would bankers not want, you know, laborers to have good wages in an 8-hour workday? It's very important to see that, you know, businessmen felt that they had built the state of California and they had done it successfully, and that they were sort of the leaders of the state, and why shouldn't they continue being able to offer direction to the state?
Yeah, if I can combine both of those answers, I think the question was about drawing parallels. It's important to draw both parallels and differences, I guess is the way that I would put it, of which there are bound to be many. And it seems to me that in writing history, to make it sort of, I hate to say come alive, what a cliche, but to make it come alive, the better way, I don't know what you guys think, but the better way is to almost not to draw parallels, but to show parallels or show differences, rather than sort of, I think you can hit people over the head with things. So you want to just try to tell the story in such a way that the differences, similarities come out to the reader in ways that are instructive or interesting.
I think that's totally right. And what Francis said, I think, is a great point. I mean, one of the things that I consciously tried to do was, frankly, in some ways, set my own politics aside and step into the boots of those who felt all those fears in the 30s, the big growers and others, you know, in the political establishment in Kern County, and really tried to understand where their fear was coming from. You know, that's sometimes a difficult exercise as a writer, but you're right, you have to do that.
You move your brain back and kind of live in the preceding era, I think.
Yeah. You know it's good when you start dreaming in the era. You literally start dreaming about the characters and you're encountering them.
Yeah, I had that
really
experience
weird.
Too. Dreaming about the Mondavi family. Yeah. Oh my goodness. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program as part of LitQuake, San Francisco's literary festival. Tonight we're talking with a panel of authors about the scandal, intrigue, and drama that can be found in California history. Our panelists are Francis Dinkelspiel, author, Towers of Gold; Ethan Rarick, author, Desperate Passage, The Donner Party's Perilous Journey; and Rick Wartzman, author, Obscene in the Extreme, The Burning and Banning of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. And I am your moderator, Julia Flynn Seiler, the author of The House of Mondavi. This is a question from the audience for Ethan. Wasn't one of the problems experienced by the Donner Party that they departed a week or so later than originally planned, and so the storms hit the mountains before they thought they would?
They departed a little later than they probably should have, but the bigger problem actually was that they took what they thought was a shortcut. To make a long story short, if I can, this is after you go through the Rocky Mountains. The traditional trail sort of went out of the way. It went to the southern edge of what's now Wyoming, then back up north into what's now Idaho, then back into Nevada, south again into Nevada, where you hit the Humboldt River. And if the Humboldt River runs right along I-80, if you've driven across Nevada. A sort of real estate promoter in California, a guy named Lansford Hastings, had looked at that and said, well, gee, if you go straight, it should be shorter. He was right. It should have been shorter if you went straight. The problem is it went right over the Wasatch Mountains, where there was no trail at all, and right across the Great Salt Lake Desert, one of the most desiccated and horrible places on Earth to this day. And the Donner Party tried to do that. And it's that cutoff, what's called the Hastings cutoff, that shortcut, proved no shortcut at all. In fact, it cost them about a month. And at the end, when they get to Donner Lake, when they get to the crest of the Sierra, they're within anywhere from a day to a few days. Probably you give them another week, and they're far enough down the western side that they're safe. So certainly that month is really what cost them.
Okay, this is a question for Francis from the audience. Was there a relationship between Hellman and Adolf Sutro?
Yes, there was a relationship between the two men. Hellman moved up to San Francisco in 1890, and I think one of the highlights of his life, because he wrote about it extensively to his families and friends, was in 1894 when he was invited to a private lunch with Adolf Sutro and former President Benjamin Harrison and the mayor of San Francisco. And there were just six people at that luncheon. And at that time, Adolf Sutro had built a magnificent mansion in the western part of the United States that had these extensive gardens that were laid out with, you know, classical statues and you know, beautiful paths. And Hellman and Sutro and the former president got to spend, I think, a whole afternoon and evening walking around there. And so they had that relationship. And of course, it's significant to note that both men were Jewish, and this is something that I talk a lot about in Towers of Gold. I think people are not as aware of the story of the Jewish contribution to the settlement of California. Jews came to California during the Gold Rush, and unlike Jews who settled in the East Coast, they were integral to the development of the state. There were no preconceived social structures that Jews had to fit themselves into. Instead, they were able to build and create just like every other person who came to California. And consequently, they were accepted everywhere. And Adolf Sutro had also came to California in the 1850s. He spent a lot of time in Nevada working on to build a tunnel to drain the Comstock Lode. And that was a 10-year project for him, and it eventually got built, and he made a lot of money out of it. And so he and Hellman traveled in the same social circles.
Unfortunately, we reached the point in our program where there's only time for a few last questions. And I wanted to start with you, Rick, if I could. One of the most moving parts of your book for me was the letter that the Kern County head librarian wrote to the Board of Supervisors protesting the ban that, of course, was taking place around the time that the Nazis were burning books in Germany. And she wrote, "Ideas don't die because a book is forbidden reading. If Steinbeck has written the truth, that truth will survive. And if he's merely being sensational and lascivious, if all the little words are really little more than fly specks on a large painting, then the book will soon go the way of all other modern novels and be forgotten." She was a very prescient lady, I think,
yes.
That librarian who is really the heroine of your story. Yep. And as a lover of public libraries everywhere, I think we have to cheer on those librarians. Would you tell me a little bit about the life of the Grapes of Wrath and the life it had in the decades since it was published?
Since it was published. Well, it continues to sell exceedingly well. We'll all be jealous. You know, it still sells about 100,000 copies a year, mostly, I assume, for high school students to read and maybe some college students to read. You know, so again, it's – but I think it's also been, you know, sort of – it's timeless because, you know, a couple reasons. It really is this quintessential story about, you know, people who have great dignity in the face of adversity. You know, the Jodes have continued to penetrate popular culture over the years. I mean, certainly immediately at the time that The Grapes of Wrath was published, you know, you had Woody Guthrie singing in his Dust Bowl ballads about the Jodes. And then, of course, the movie version of The Grapes of Wrath came out the following year in 1940. It was made incredibly quickly. The novel was finished. Steinbeck finished it in April of 1939, and Nunnally Johnson had finished the screenplay by July. So this thing was turned right around. And, you know, it's just continued to resonate. I mean, you know, Bruce Springsteen and Rage Against the Machine singing about the ghost of Tom Joad. And again, you know, with the economic parallels to today, I was struck recently there were a group of electrical workers from Michigan who recently traveled to Iowa because they were so desperate for jobs. They traveled hundreds of miles, and this was during the flooding in Iowa this last summer. And they had to live outside in tents and crummy conditions, but they were so desperate for jobs, they went and did this. And the Harley Shaken, who some of you may know, labor expert up here at UC Berkeley, he looked at this desperate scene, you know, and one image popped into his head. He said, "What's going on in Detroit right now is just like the Jodes streaming out of Oklahoma." So again, I think, you know, that's sort of an indelible piece of America.
And of course, it lives on in your book as well.
Probably I hope so, anyway, yes.
Recent iteration. And Ethan, this is a question from the audience. How does the Donner Party tragedy reflect on the classic means justifying the ends argument?
I guess, to be honest, I don't know that it applies because I think that suggests that the means were negative. I mean, to the classic use of a means justifying the ends is to the ends justifying the means, rather, is to say that you can do something awful in pursuit of a good goal. In this case, I'm not convinced, as I said earlier, that they did something awful. I think they did what they had to do, and so I think it's sort of justified on its face. So I don't find it. I don't find their means. Again, with the one exception of the two people who were killed, and that's a sort of side story. But I don't find what they did to really need justification. I think it justifies itself. They survived. People have to survive.
Well, I need to follow up with my last question now, which is I wanted to ask you, Dana Goodyear in the New York Times Book Review praised your book for humanizing the members of the Donner Party. And you had mentioned that you'd worked with new archival material from Tamzine Donner, mm-hmm. who was the mother. And the end of Tamzine is very poignant in your book. She chooses to send her children on ahead and stay with her dying husband. And as a consequence, she dies. And you told that in a very understated way, related that history. How did you feel about it, and what did her diaries or letters say about that experience at if you had material up until that point?
Well, these are the new letters, I think, cast light on this part of the story. As Julia said, at the end of the story, Tamzin faces the following decision. Her husband is too sick to walk out. He's going to die. Her three little girls, toddlers, are healthy enough to go out, and there are rescuers who are willing to take them out. She can either go with her daughters and leave her husband there to die alone, or she can stay with her husband and care for him and let her daughters go out with the rescuers, but it's quite clear at that point that she will then die too with her husband. So basically her choice is she can either let her husband die alone or she can orphan her children. She chooses to stay with her husband. And I think that this may have, and this is surmise on my part, because we don't, since she dies, we don't have anything that says exactly why she chose to do this. She didn't survive to write letters later describing her thoughts or whatever. But in the new letters that came to light about a decade ago, she talks about the death of this first family that I mentioned earlier. Long before the Donner Party journey west in the 1830s, she had been a young woman in North Carolina, a school teacher, got married, had a baby, a little boy, became pregnant again with a little girl, and then in the course of 3 months, her son dies, she miscarries with the baby daughter, and her husband dies. Her husband dies on Christmas Eve. So in 3 months, she goes from having a very happy, prosperous young family to having nobody, to being by herself. And it seems to me that it's impossible that when she faces this choice at the end of the Donner Party story, she doesn't think back to that. And she doesn't think back to her children who had died and her husband who had died. And I don't know exactly what the calculus is. I don't know how she weighs that. I can't imagine weighing that choice. But I think somehow she has to think back to the death of that first family, and she must have decided that she just couldn't leave her dying husband. Having had her first family die, she just couldn't leave him there to die alone. And he would have been utterly alone. In their camp, they were actually camped slightly away from Donner Lake. In their camp, there was nobody else left. So it seems to me impossible that she didn't think back to that. And she chooses in the end, as I say, to stay with her husband. She dies. Her children are taken out and they live.
There's one question for me, so I think I'll answer it, and then we'll go to Francis. This question from the audience is, I'd like to hear about Robert Mondavi and his influence on California. Robert Mondavi, as many of you probably know, passed away a few months ago at the age of 94, very peacefully at his home in Napa Valley. And he very much is part of California history. He and his family helped revive the California wine industry after Prohibition, and particularly helped to change Napa into a valley that at that point in the late 30s was best known for its mental institution into one that's now best known for Cabernet, producing wonderful Cabernets. And one of the surprising things to me about what has happened with my book, The House of Mondavi, is it is now entering into business history. And I'm being contacted by business schools and by students who are very interested in studying the rise of the California wine industry and the contribution of the Mondavi family to that, not to mention some of the scandals, intrigues, and other things that this panel is about. But turning to Francis for a final question, I saw on your website, Francis, that a bluegrass song about Isaias Hellman is the works. Could you tell us more about that? And does that have anything to do with Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival that took place in Golden Gate Park this weekend in San Francisco?
Oh, absolutely. Well, I'm a fifth-generation Californian, and Hellmans have been in this state for a long time. And while Isaias Hellman was very, very famous in his lifetime, he's certainly been eclipsed by a different Hellman now, a man named Warren Hellman, who put on the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival this weekend in the park. It's the eighth festival that Warren has put on. He invites about 80 musicians, and they play for 3 days over five stages in Golden Gate Park. And I was there yesterday, and there were more than 100,000 people just there yesterday. So it's a fantastic celebration, and it's remarkable, a remarkable way that a man who has made a lot of money also in the financial sector decides to use it. He wants to give it away and have people have a fun time. Warren Hellman is a banjo player, and after I wrote this book, Towers of Gold, I gave it to Warren, and he decided he wanted to compose a song about Isaias Hellman. So he has composed a song, and I will spare all of you. I will not sing it right now.
No, we want to hear it, Francis.
No, but he did. He has a band called The Wronglers, and they did play the song yesterday at the Bluegrass Festival, and it's going to be on my website. The final mix hasn't happened, but it will be on my website, Towers of Gold.
You won't just sing us the refrain?
No, Fancy. But there's a lot about, making money and saving California and all sorts of good stuff like that.
Okay, so now we have the Donner Party Cookbook. We've learned about that. We've learned about Isaias Hellman. Well, I have a very happy surprise. We actually have extra time because you all are so succinct. It's amazing. So I think I'll look at some more questions from the audience. And we have a few more minutes. Oh, this is a good one, and I'm just going to toss it open to whoever feels like tackling it. Have any of you written fiction, or do you have any such aspirations?
Not intentionally.
I've thought about it, and I've always found it hard to write fiction. Although I think I'd love to, but I've always found it hard because I sort of get into it a little ways, and I want to interview the characters and find out what they want to do next. So it's difficult. It's a different beast, I think, than writing nonfiction.
I have actually no interest in writing fiction. I think it's such a fun challenge to write narrative nonfiction because you're presented with a certain number of facts, and you can't go beyond those facts, and it takes a lot of creativity to figure out how to just use the small amount of information you have and write an engaging narrative. And believe me, it's challenging enough.
Well, I just have to challenge all three of you here. I've read your books very carefully, and I have to say that one thing that distinguishes all of your books is that they are page-turners and that they are written novelistically, even though they're true. And I think that there is a trend amongst nonfiction writers to try to borrow techniques from fiction writers.
You definitely do borrow techniques. And I think, first of all, it's all storytelling in the end. It's a narrative. It's got a good beginning, middle, and end, you hope. And the other thing that you do, I think, with history is you end up making a lot of leaps. I mean, you gather letters, you gather all this archival material, you interview people. But even when you do that, sometimes you get letters and you get multiple letters, and there's conflicting accounts of what actually happened. Or certainly when you interview people, I mean, if we were to ask all of you, what happened at this panel tonight, we'd get 100 different answers, right? And so it's hard sometimes to reconcile those things. And I think, one of your jobs is to again, to sort of tell that narrative, be as faithful as you can to the facts, but, it's tricky, and that's where the novelistic techniques come in sometimes. You end up making some leaps, I think.
Yeah, and I think nonfiction is shaped by the author in a way as much as fiction.
Absolutely.
Because of the process that Rick's talking about, where you take what you have and sort of shape it into a narrative, because it doesn't come that way. No. You don't learn about it in a narrative sense.
Well, I'll toss out a question. Are there any histories that you all have read that you would recommend to us, particularly California histories, that you think have either tackled corners of history that most people weren't aware of or familiar with, or that told the stories in very engaging ways? That's Francis, you're a fantastic reader. Anything comes to mind?
Sure. Desperate Passage and I've Seen the Extreme. Two really good books.
What, you want us to buy you a drink afterwards? Rick mentioned Kerry McWilliams earlier. He mentioned Factories in the Field. There's another wonderful book by Kerry McWilliams called California, the Great Exception, which is kind of remains a classic California nonfiction.
Really
book
prescient.
Yes. There's a tremendous amount of great California history out there. I don't think I could limit it to one book.
Well, I'd have to agree with Francis that we have three fantastic books here. And a big thank you to our panelists, Francis Dinkelspiel, author, Towers of Gold, Ethan Rarick, author, Desperate Passage, The Donner Party's Perilous Journey, Rick Wartzman, author, Obscene in the Extreme, The Burning and Banning of John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath. And we also thank our audiences here and on the radio. This program is generously underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We also thank the California Historical Society, Litquake, and the San Francisco Museum and Historical Society. I'm Julia Flynn Seiler, author of The House of Mondavi, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Well done. I like the gavel, too.